Okay. Howard Braun and Selma Weiss interviewing Dr. Ralph Roeske's oral history to National Council of Jewish Women
on December.
On December 19th, 1996.
This is Ralph Roeske's. I live at 5441 Albemarle in Squirrel Hill.
Dr. Roeske's, let's start at the beginning. How about who were your grandparents and your parents, and where were they from?
Okay. My father was born in a small town just outside of Bialystok, which is either Poland or Russia, depending on which day of the week you look at it. His family was actually, they were Ger Chassidim in a Litvak environment, so they were outsiders. My mother was born in Budapest and moved at a young age to Vienna, so she grew up in Vienna. Her parents came from Galicia. My grandfather was born in Stryi, and my grandmother, on my mother's side, was born in Lemberg.
Do you recall any of their native languages, which ones they had, and did any come through to you?
Sure. In my house, growing up, well, let me just continue a little bit further. My parents met and married in Europe. My father at the time was living in Romania. And so my mother, they got married in Vienna and immediately moved to Romania. Theirs, my mother tells me that theirs was the last large Jewish wedding in Vienna before the Anschluss. They got married in January 30th of 1938, and the Anschluss was the beginning of March in 38. Between January and March, they left and went to Romania. And they sort of foresaw that things were going to be bad. They didn't quite understand how bad. But my father was at that time the director of a rubber mill in Chernivtsi in Romania, and he managed to get a visa to go to the World's Fair in 1939 on the grounds that he was businessman and would look at economic opportunities and so on. And he and his brothers came. They didn't get permission to move into the United States, to emigrate into the United States at that point, but you could go to Canada. And so he and his brothers in 1939 officially went to the World's Fair, ended up going in Canada and establishing a cloth factory, which had been their family business before my father went into the rubber business. So he and his brothers established a woolen mill in just outside of Montreal, and I was born in 1940 in Montreal.
What was the day you were born?
November 24, 1940. In my parents, my mother spoke both English and French. When they moved here, she had actually spent some time studying in the Sorbonne, so her French was really quite good, and her English was very good too. My father, at that time, knew seven languages, none of which was English or French, and so he ended up learning, of course, English and French afterwards. So he ended up knowing nine languages. In my house, we had help in the house, French Canadians, so people spoke French. My father spoke Yiddish, and my mother spoke German. So there were, besides English, there were three languages in the house. So I ended up, my very first sentence, my mother tells me, was in French. There's a very funny story. She was evidently talking French to me when I was a little kid. We lived in the English-speaking part of Montreal. And one day, this is a story that she tells me, we were outside, maybe I was 4 years old or something like that, and we lived in a duplex, and the people living underneath us, actually the son of that person now lives here in Pittsburgh, Weisenfeld, Dr. Weisenfeld, must have been a seven-year-old kid or something, looked at my mother and said, Mrs. Roskies, are you Jewish? And she said, yes, why do you ask? And he looked at her and said, don't you know that the language of the Jews is English? Which is a very profound statement about the sociology of Jewry in Montreal and so on. So eventually I went to English-speaking schools and...
Continue on the school comments you're making, what happened in your schooling, in your elementary schooling,
yeah.
Where and how and who.
I went to regular public schools. In Montreal, the whole school system is religiously organized. And there's the Catholic school board and the Protestant school board. And in general, the Jews went to the Protestant school board. And the Protestant school board was overwhelmingly English, and the Catholic school board was overwhelmingly French. Later on, they developed a very elaborate system of Jewish schools in Montreal. But at that time, at least I wasn't aware of such things. So I went to a regular public school, and then I went for religious education. I went to afternoon school at the synagogue. We belonged to a conservative synagogue, very right-wing conservative synagogue called Shara Shamayim, famous synagogue in Montreal. And that's where I went to
Do you have any recollection of the rabbi's name by any chance?
Oh, sure. I mean, the rabbi there for many years was Rabbi Shushat.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think he became rabbi in 1948 or something like that. Before him, there was Rabbi Abramowitz, whose name I just vaguely remember. Oh, I even remember, you know, the teachers that I had in that school. But in addition, my father was very learned in Jewish matters. I mean, he spoke, I told you he had spoke nine languages eventually, but he was very fluent in Hebrew, and Yiddish was, of course, his main language. And he knew Tanakh.
Mm-hmm.
Inside out.
Mm-hmm.
So he was somewhat concerned that the quality of education I was getting in the Hebrew school wasn't quite enough. And so I, in addition, had private lessons from an old-style teacher named Mr. Leaf, who taught me more Hebrew, and with him I studied some Talmud and so on. So I got a very good Jewish education, but not through the Jewish school system.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, for example, went to Hebrew Day School by the time, in Montreal. But I never did.
Well, you've now got to, as far as your wife. You may as well tell us just at least a little bit about how'd you meet her.
Well, as I say, I went through the whole school system, public school, Protestant school system in Quebec, in Montreal, and as almost everybody did at that time, I went to McGill as an undergraduate. People didn't go away to school at that time. And I actually, in my third year, as an undergraduate, I got to be very active in Hillel, and in the third year, I was president of Hillel. And one of the things we did at Hillel was to sponsor dances, and we sponsored a dance for incoming freshmen just as I was starting my term as president of Hillel. And there was this beautiful girl who came to this dance, and one of my friends knew who she was. I didn't know who she was. She was from a different part of Montreal, and I asked him to introduce her to me, and he did, and that's my wife. So we met...
What was her name?
Her name is Dodie. Everybody knows her as Dodie. Her official name is Dolores. Her family name was Dines, D-I-N-E-S.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember her parents' professional name?
Oh, sure, sure. Her father was a dress contractor.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother sometimes worked with him.
Mm-hmm.
Her father just died this past July. My father died in 1985. And both mothers are still alive, both living in Montreal still.
Let's step back just a little. Do you have any siblings? And
Yeah. I have a sister who was born a year after me, in December 41, named Doreen. She married a New York lawyer. They live in Larchmont. She has three children. My wife has a brother who's 8 years older than her, who's a periodontist who now lives in Boston, and a sister who's 8 years younger than her, who also now lives in Boston, and she's a lawyer there. Mm-hmm. Her brother has four sons, and her sister has a daughter. I guess I didn't tell you yet that I have three daughters, but we'll get to that later.
Yes, we'll get to that later.
Her parents, my wife's parents, were both from Poland/Russia. Her mother was from Pinsk, and her father was from Slonim. And they also spoke Yiddish at home, so both Dodi and I are fluent Yiddish speakers. Mm-hmm. And as I say, she went to Hebrew day school, so she actually spoke Hebrew better than I did when I met her. We subsequently spent a lot of time in Israel. We lived there for a while. One of our kids was born there, so we're both fluent in Hebrew.
Tell us a little bit about your religious, usually here, on a simple level, were you bar mitzvah? Very elementary in your case, but just a little bit about the religious environment and practice.
Yeah. My father, as I told you, came from a Hasidic background. He was traditional in many ways. It's very interesting to contrast my parents' Judaism with my wife's parents' Judaism, because it was really quite different. My mother grew up in Vienna, was sort of assimilated to some extent Jewish community in Vienna, and so she was much less religiously oriented than my father was. When I grew up, there was just no question, every Shabbos we went to shul. I mean, there was just never any question about this, and I enjoyed this. I would be with my father the whole time, and we walked the synagogue together and walked home together and so on. I liked that very much. But, for example, we didn't keep a kosher home. Partly it was because my mother determined what the household was like, and she didn't come from a kosher background. And my father was a very progressive person in many ways. And the thing about my Jewish upbringing was that not only did I learn what was going on, but I sort of learned the rationale for what was going on all the time. My father would explain things to me and so on. I remember the first time we went to Israel. Was remarkable. It was 1960. I went with my parents and my sister to Israel. My mother had a brother who left Vienna and went to Israel. When she left Romania and went to the States, he went to Israel. So we had close relatives in Israel. And we went on a tour and we had a guide. And everybody has their tourist books and they're looking through the tourist books and so on. And my father, the only thing my father brought along was a Tanakh. And as we'd go through towns, he would flip the pages and he would say, "You remember this part? You remember this?" It was just wonderful. Anyway, my wife's parents, on the other hand, my wife's mother in particular, was very committed to having a kosher home. So she grew up very, very kosher, but they never went to synagogue or maybe Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. So it was very, very strange when we met. I mean, each of us thought we were intermarrying. So
you were.
Yes.
And do you remember your seder?
Sure. Toldot.
Toldot?
Yeah.
Do you remember if you said anything about it?
Well, it's interesting. I actually learned the entire Torah reading. Mm-hmm. And I could probably still do it. Mm-hmm. But the synagogue was a very formal and straight-laced synagogue, and when push came to shove, they wouldn't let me do it. So, I mean, I only did the Maftir and the Haftorah, but I was prepared to do the entire Sedra.
Good for you. And do you recall anything concerning the Jewish-non-Jewish interaction in your elementary school. I'm going to ask you the same question about high school. Was there anti-Semitism in any way that affected you? Or were everyone in your circle Jewish?
Socially, we certainly had, my parents had almost exclusively Jewish friends. The class I went to, of course, was not mostly Jewish, was mostly non-Jewish. There were lots of Jews.
You said you were in a different
place. It was called it's the Protestant School Board
Protestant
system.
Yeah.
I went to a school called Roslyn School for grades kindergarten through six, and then Westmount Junior High, and then Westmount Senior High. I never really personally anywhere came across any anti-Semitism that I could identify. It was clear to me in retrospect that there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Quebec in general. And my wife's brother, for example, I told you was 8 years older than her, he had really wanted to go to med school at McGill. And at that time, they took very few Jewish kids into the med school. I mean, that was just understood. You know, life has changed. The president of McGill now is a Jew, but...
You happen to realize or remember whether the Catholic school, with regard to this, was different or the same?
We never interacted with the Catholic schools. I never met kids who went to Catholic schools, so I knew it existed, but anybody who lived in our neighborhood went to Protestant schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, go on from there to high school. What happened?
Nothing very remarkable happened in high school.
Were you smart?
I was smart. In fact, they have a high school leaving exam in Quebec. The Protestant School Board has a high school leaving exam, which they give to all kids at the end of... We only had 11 grades, which I think is a great idea. I don't think you need 12 grades of schooling. But anyway, we only had 11 grades. And at the end of 11th grade, there was this province-wide test that you took, and they made a big to-do about people who did well on that test, and I ended up getting the best score in the whole province, so my picture was all over the newspaper and so on. And my father actually told me once, a year later or so, that he knew I was smart, and especially because my mother kept telling him I was smart, but he never thought, you know, he says every mother is proud of their son, so... He was sort of surprised by this.
That you were that smart.
That I was that smart. Which in a way, I realized in retrospect also, was wonderful because he never put any major pressure on me. It wasn't as though his son was expected to perform like this. He just thought of it as a great bonus.
What happened?
My mother was more driven in this respect than my father. I certainly felt the pressure from my mother, but it was a very intellectual household.
Okay, what happened at McGill?
Well, throughout high school, it was clear I really loved math, and then when I took physics, I really liked physics a lot, so I was pretty sure when I went to McGill that I wanted to study math and physics, and that's what I did. And I ended up winning. There's a gold medal that they give for the math and physics courses, and I ended up winning the gold medal at McGill, and then I went to graduate school in Princeton, and I got a PhD there in 1965. My PhD advisor is a very famous physicist, Eugene Wigner. Nobel Prize winner, one of the Hungarian transplants to the United States. It was also fun to see when my mother came to visit. I told you that she was born in Budapest. She speaks fluent Hungarian, of course, and they got along just great.
How is it that you came to the U.S. and in the end, everyone in your family seems to have gravitated
Good point.
From Canada to the Yes.
Yeah, I came mostly for just professional reasons. Physics in the United States was a lot better than physics in Canada. When I came, I didn't come with the clear idea that I was going to emigrate to the United States and stay in the United States. But I got a position after I graduated from Princeton. I got a position at Yale. And in the meantime, the political situation in Quebec got worse from the point of view of English-speaking Montrealers, English-speaking Canadians.
What year are you talking about?
The late 60s. You know, people tend to date it to de Gaulle coming to the World's Fair in 1967 and giving this famous speech on Vive le Québec libre and all that. But you could feel it. And from the perspective of the 60s, there was a lot of justice to the French cause at that time. They really, the English really dominated the economic life of the city of Montreal, and you would expect, if you walked into a store, you would expect the salesperson to talk to you in English. We all had to learn French. I mean, I knew French just because I told you we had French maids, and so I actually ended up speaking French, but we all had to learn French in school, but it was pretty perfunctory, and it was clear that English was the dominant language.
You know, the license plate in those days used to say, Je me souviens. What does that mean?
It means I remember.
What did they remember?
Well, actually, I don't know if it's that old. I mean, it's lately that it says, Je me souviens. I suspect that it's...
it's that old.
They're trying to revive, if you wish, the French heritage. Now, I think they've gone way too far. And the situation has changed. I think Montreal as a city has really suffered enormously. It was a fabulous city in the 50s and 60s. I mean, there was the French culture, there was the English culture, it was by far the most, I would probably in North America, the most cosmopolitan city in terms of fashion and so on. And
your friends and family and perhaps other English have left some. I'd like you to mention that a little bit. What do you know about that?
So all my, you know, my sister and my wife's two siblings have all left because of the perceived, largely because of the perceived difficulty of continuing to live in Montreal as an English-speaking person, and especially bringing up kids as English-speaking people. You could do it. I mean, you can still go to English-speaking schools. We were grandfathered in, and that is, the rule is if your parents went to English-speaking schools, you can go to English-speaking schools. But it's a very strained and artificial situation, and economically the city is dying. So,
yeah, we're terrified not to live there.
Yeah, well, terrified I think is too strong a word, but I think they're more depressed than anything else. My father had three brothers that were in the business with him. It was a family business of the four brothers, and each of those brothers had children and so on. And very few of them are still in Montreal at this point. Most of them have emigrated, some to Israel and some to the United States.
When you graduated from Yale,
Princeton.
What was the degree?
Well, the degree is formally mathematics, but it was mathematical physics. Really.
Mathematical physics. And when you went to teach at Yale, what did you do?
I taught in the physics department.
You taught in the physics department.
Right.
And how long were you at Yale?
I started at Yale in 65. We took 1 year in 67 and went to Israel. I spent a year at the Weizmann Institute. I started at Yale in 65 as an instructor. In 67, I went to the Weizmann Institute. I came back to Yale as an assistant professor in 68. I won a junior faculty fellowship to go to Stanford in 71. And when I was at Stanford, I got this offer from Pitt. to come to the physics department at Pitt.
And how long were you at Stanford?
Just that 1 year.
Just that 1 year.
And I was, I mean, my affiliation was still Yale, except that I was spending the year at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got this offer from Pitt. And
which was?
You know, physics department, associate professor, tenure to be granted essentially a year after I got here. And so I came in 72, in the summer of 72 we moved here.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been here ever since.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what you did at Pitt, what you did, not what you're now doing.
Well, I was...
How did your Pitt career go?
How did my Pitt career go?
Yeah. What were you doing and with whom?
Well, let's see. I got here in 72, and at that time, I had, during my year in Stanford, I had figured out some interesting way to attack some problems in elementary particle physics. And it turned out there was somebody at Carnegie Mellon named Mike Levine who had developed techniques that would be very useful if we were going to try to work on such problems. So I remember very clearly that when I came to interview at Pitt, I made a point of seeking out Michael and talking to him about a possible collaboration if I were to come here and so on. And that's exactly what happened. And he and I, starting in 72, worked together for close to 10 years, around 10 years, on a series of problems in elementary particle physics. As I say, I came here as an associate professor, and I got tenure almost immediately, sort of the next year, and I was promoted to full professor in 79. Just because it's relevant to what I'm doing now, I'll just give you a little other history, and that was that I was interested in some aspects of computing and how computing can be used in theoretical physics and so on, and had a lot to do with the work I was doing with Michael, but I ended up being on a committee at Pitt, which ended up looking into what we could do about improving the computing situation for people who wanted to do large-scale computing at Pitt. And just about when I was on that committee, there was a solicitation from the National Science Foundation to establish academically based supercomputing centers. And there was going to be a competition for this. And I remember very clearly Michael asking me whether I thought it would be worth putting in a proposal for this. And I thought he was totally crazy. And I told him, you know, who would give us a Cray? And that was the kind of machine you would get at that time, which is so far beyond what we were thinking about. And I still remember his answer. It was a wonderful answer. And he said, who else do you think they should give it to? And I thought about it for a weekend. And as I say, I was on this committee at Pitt, and I was trying to push the administration into doing something better than what we had for high-performance computing. I didn't think we had a chance in hell of getting a supercomputer here at Pitt. But I thought if I put in several months of really hard work, pull together this proposal, what would happen would be that I would sort of create a cadre of people that was really interested in high-performance computing, and then we could go and beat up on the administration and get them to do something more than they were prepared to do otherwise. So we worked very hard the summer of 84.
We.
Michael and I.
I'd like you to drop as many names as you can.
Right, Michael Levine. And as I told you, I had this collaboration with him starting in 72. Mm-hmm. At that point, we were no longer collaborating. We had each gone on to work on a different set of problems.
Mm-hmm.
But we pulled together with a guy at Westinghouse, we put together a proposal to the National Science Foundation. As I say, I didn't think we had a serious chance.
Who was the guy?
The guy at Westinghouse was Jim Kasdorf, who was...
K-A, I believe.
K-A-S-D-O-R-F.
Yeah, I know him.
He's still there. He's still working with us. He had been... I think his title... I never remember these titles very well. At some point, he was director of supercomputing for Westinghouse. Mm-hmm. Whether he was at that time director of supercomputing or not, I don't know. But I mean, that's also an interesting story, which I can tell you about how I met Kasdorf and so on. But we pulled him in, Michael and I. It was my suggestion to involve Westinghouse in this proposal.
They had supercomputers.
They had two supercomputers. They had two Cray 1s at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up writing this proposal to the National Science Foundation, which ended up being successful, and we now have in Pittsburgh.
What year was that?
We wrote the proposal in 84. And it took the National Science Foundation a little over a year to decide to award us the Supercomputing Center. And so what's called the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center was established in 1986. January. In January, we got the okay from the National Science Foundation, and we were up and running by June of 1986. And we're now one of four national supercomputing centers, and we've done very well.